financial literacy, and the human condition. Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Raham.
I mean, you're going to talk to a doctor who, you know, and obviously Dr. Alex really cares about the situation, the whole system, you know, and it's, you want to go in there and know that you've got somebody who's going to give you the answers or give you the right, send you the right direction. You know, yeah. This is great. This is great.
In your experience, do you find that even financial stress itself can, and it's okay if your answer is no, it's fine, you know, but can it influence the emotional or even the physical side of the fertility treatment?
I can think of a couple of my patients right now that are trying to decide, because of their coverage situation, which treatment they want to do, because they might have coverage for this, but not for that. And this is going to be out of pocket, but this is covered, but has a lower chance of success. And the timing that goes into that and the psychological impact of that. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Hi, it's Francis. I just wanted to take a minute to thank you for watching this video. If you're catching us on YouTube, please help us help others by clicking like, subscribe, and all notifications so you don't miss any videos. And check back for the next video. I think you're going to love it. Thanks again. For more information, you can visit us at hugyourmoney.com.
Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Raham. I'm Jay Dean, and we're very excited for this show.
We are. We have a wonderful guest today, and I've asked him to come back to give him more time to expand his views and to have our followers understand his voice a little bit better, because I just loved the half-hour show we did together. His name is Dr. Alexander Kucherov, and he is double board certified in OBGYN, or obstetrics and gynecology, and reproductive endocrinology and infertility. So as part of the Illum fertility team where he works, he not only guides patients through the medical side of things of building a family, but he also understands, without turning him into a financial advisor, how timing, access, and affordability actually shape those decisions. So we are thrilled to have him back for a deeper conversation today. And we'll talk about those kinds of things, affordability, access, demographics, all the nerd stuff I like to talk about. But this is all as it pertains to real life. So welcome back, Dr. Alex.
Thank you so much, Francis. Glad to be back here.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate, with your busy schedule, that you and your team carved out time to do this show, because I think it's so valuable for people to understand that even though we talk to them about money, life is not about money. Money is the tool. So when things can align like this and we can talk about reaching your dreams, your goals, and make it accessible to people, I'm in favor of all of that. I wonder if you would begin by sharing your personal story with us. For people watching this who don't know what happened to you personally, would you mind starting off with that?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So I became interested in fertility in medical school. I really enjoyed my OBGYN and endocrinology courses and did my residency in OBGYN. In my residency, I met my wife, and I did some research and began my fellowship in reproductive endocrinology and fertility after that. But we had our own fertility challenges. By the way, like I mentioned before, she is okay with me talking about this on there. We did have that conversation.
So that's a good thing.
Very important.
Yes.
So it took us, you know, the better part of a year to conceive our first son. And it was very challenging. And to be in a personal fertility challenge while studying and learning how to treat folks with the same condition was a real eye-opening experience. You can imagine, you know, I practice OBGYN, but as a man, I never can have the full experience, let's say, to be able to totally relate to my patients. But from a fertility standpoint, I can certainly, in some ways, relate to some of the challenges that folks are going through. So we did end up using some medication to help ovulation happen a little bit faster, a little bit on a more of a regular schedule. And that is considered low-level fertility treatment, and that has how we conceived our first son.
That's wonderful. And you have two children?
We do have two kids, two boys, and I was told the shop is now closed.
I was just going to ask, are we planning number three? Okay. You just learned this.
I just say, I've got two brothers, so three is okay, but it's Certainly up to the docs.
I'm not the boss, so.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes. Well, I'm grateful to your wife also for being so open. I think one of the things that keeps people from progressing in areas, we certainly see it in finance, and I'm sure you see it medically, is the shame, the fear, the guilt, the feeling responsible, the not wanting to share this stuff out loud, to say this out loud. And I don't see the shame in this, right? I mean, but historically, we have a lot of baggage about things like this.
Absolutely. I mean, 12% of couples in the world are affected by fertility challenges. That's a lot of people. And that is just the people that we know about. I mean,
Right.
imagine, I mean, talk about these are folks that are like reported that are seeking care. And there are so many other people out there who are not seeking care for one reason or another, possibly for financial reasons. But also folks who don't even necessarily know that there's a challenge that they're having. And the education about that is extremely important as well.
Yeah, for certain. I think you bring up a good point. Those are only the people we know about, and that's 12%. I wonder what do you think? Do you have any feel for how many people it really is?
Well, we know that there are many folks out there with ovulatory disorders, for example, PCOS and ovulatory issues. That it's a larger percentage of the population than we know about. And many of those folks may or may not be seeking pregnancy, but if they did not have ovulatory issues, might be conceiving and would be captured as part of those statistics. But many of them are perhaps not using birth control and also not ovulating and are thus not conceiving. They might not be seeking care, but that is a huge number of people. And that's just, I think, the tip of the iceberg. There's plenty of other people that may have had appendicitis when they were a child, and now one of their tubes is blocked, or both of their tubes are blocked. They don't even know, and maybe they're just, again, not using birth control. And it's like, hey, I'm not getting pregnant, but well, I'm not going to seek care right now, or whatever. There's lots of different things like that.
Yeah, I wonder if you see a difference in who comes to you, like younger versus older couples, single parents by choice, same-sex couples, and how that ties into affordability. Maybe that's two separate questions, but
No, it's a fabulous question. We actually have data on that.
really.
So about 25 to 30 years ago, the larger proportion of folks presenting to fertility practices were younger folks with ovulatory disorders like polycystic ovarian syndrome and other issues where the eggs are not being released on a regular schedule. But typically, most folks were in their 20s or 30s. And also there was very limited coverage, so most of these folks were paying with cash for any fertility treatment in the 90s, let's say 90s, early 2000s. However, in the past 15 years or so, it's been a marked shift where most folks now are in their 30s and 40s and usually have what we call diminished ovarian reserve, which is lower egg numbers. At the same time, the quality of the eggs has changed pretty dramatically in the late 30s, early 40s. So it's a little bit of a double whammy. On the other hand, at least where I practice in New York and Connecticut, many folks do have insurance coverage now, at least for testing and usually for fertility treatment as well. Not everybody, of course, but most of them do.
Yeah, we're going to get into that a little bit too, as much as you'll let us. So,
Doc,
so
can I
far,
throw something at you real quick too?
absolutely, Jay.
It's funny watching the previous show that you were on here with Dr. Ram. I'm guilty. Oh, just relax and you'll get pregnant. And
Oh.
it's just one of those, things that gets handed down, and I'm an old guy, and so I mean, it's not that simple, obviously.
It's really not. Absolutely, yes. And that that was a sort of, let's say, classic way approach to it. But a lot of people took that approach because there was no other evidence or research about what to do. And it's in the absence of that, you kind of start coming up with things. Maybe it is, quote, just stress that's causing me to not conceive. And we know, and the research bears this out, that that's typically not the case. Stress can cause fertility issues in some folks, for sure. But it usually presents as changing the menstrual cycle and leading to irregular ovulation or ovulatory disorders. And that can certainly lead to challenges in conceiving, but not usually like, oh, my auntie is very stressful and I'm feeling it, or my job, this and that, those sorts of things.
I can tell that question really bothers you.
It does.
Actually, I could see the reaction on you, like, oh, that there it is again about just relax. I love Jay. He's a super nice guy, and he was very honest
Absolutely.
to bring that up. But I think that, there's a lot of misconceptions, right? But I have a question that just came to mind. So far, we're talking about eggs, 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 and I'm thinking about people who blame their partners. It's all your fault, or who don't outwardly blame them, but secretly do. Can you talk to us a little bit about the other side of that? How does stress and affordability and lifestyle all feed into what's going on for the partner?
For sure. All of those things can affect outcomes, as you know. Certainly the most common things that we see are lifestyle related that can affect the sperm. The most common things would be smoking, although not as much anymore, which is good.
Yeah.
Smoking is, as in general, on the wane in this country, mercifully. But certainly smoking can affect sperm numbers, affect sperm quality, sperm DNA integrity. We're learning a lot more about that in the past couple of years. How DNA integrity of the sperm itself can lead to increased risk of pregnancy loss, even if you do conceive. So lots of those sorts of things. One of the actually less uncommon things that we see are folks using now testosterone. So this is really, coming through in the past couple of years. It used to be that we would see most of the folks using injectable testosterone replacement were like bodybuilders and folks that were in perhaps a profession where they needed to have bulky muscle for their job or whatever the case may be. But there are a lot of folks out there now that are getting testosterone because they were perhaps diagnosed with low testosterone from their doctor, or various other things, right? Which it's a totally fine treatment to treat those things, but if you flood your system with injectable testosterone, the testicles say, "Oh, I have all this testosterone. I don't need any more right now." So they stop making their own testosterone. And it turns out for sperm production, you need high levels of local testosterone in the testes being produced by the testes. And that's why the sperm count goes down extremely quickly if you're using injectable testosterone. So those are some of the things that people are doing from a lifestyle standpoint. From a support standpoint, as we talked about in the prior show, I am grateful that most of the time the male partners of folks that I see here are usually very involved and very proactive and really willing to do whatever it takes in order to achieve success and achieve their goals and dreams. And that's really a beautiful thing. Sometimes it is not the case, though. I've certainly have folks where they don't want to involve their male partners until they get checked out. Or have some more information from their standpoint. Perhaps they don't want to talk to their partners about it, and that's, of course, up to them. But that does still occur sometimes, for sure.
While we're talking about all the the techno medical stuff, just before we came on the show, I saw you look at your screen and go, and I thought, what's the matter? And you had a story that you said you were willing to share with us. Would you give us the human side of this? When this works, how's it go?
It's really beautiful. I had a really, really lovely, wonderful patient of mine come into the office today to show us how her pregnancy was going. And she's about 20 plus weeks pregnant. She's having a girl, very exciting. And she came to see me. She's 45 years old, which is very challenging to conceive at that age. The egg quality is typically quite low, and egg numbers are typically quite low, but it's not impossible. She did have insurance coverage, which did cover fertility treatment and checkup. And she did an IVF cycle and made one embryo, which is not a lot of embryos, one embryo. And she did genetic chromosomal testing, and it turned out to be chromosomally normal. And we did the embryo transfer. And even a chromosomally normal embryo does not have 100% chance of a positive test. There's a lot of other things that need to happen. So we quote anywhere from a 50 to 70% chance of a positive test. And even with a positive test, 10 to 15% chance of a pregnancy loss under those circumstances. So nothing's ever guaranteed, but we did the transfer and she's pregnant and she came to say hi. And she brought her daughter, who is in her 20s, and her daughter's daughter, who is 5 months old. So it's a beautiful family. And she was really lovely. And she pointed at her granddaughter and said, "This is my baby's aunt. She's 5 months old." Really, really beautiful and a really lovely, beautiful human being.
That reminded me of the movie. You've Got Mail. Yeah, You've Got Mail, which was really a remake of The Shop Around the Corner, although I think a lot of people don't recognize that. And there is a scene in there where Tom Hanks is introducing this little boy and this little girl, and one of them is his aunt. And the Meg Ryan says, "Oh no, I don't think you could be his aunt." And he goes through the whole, iteration of who is whom, and then says, "We are an American family." It's the sweetest scene. Yeah,
It's
yeah, yeah.
exactly right. And in my own family, we were talking about this before. My wife has two sisters who are, 18 and 20 years younger than her, basically. That's life and that's love, and it's really beautiful.
Yeah.
We're certainly enjoying our time with Dr. Alex. We have a lot more coming up, but Francis, I'm sure people have questions. Can we get your phone number?
Wow. Of course, this time is flying by.
Yes.
413-773-3333.
Or as always, go to hugyourmoney.com. We'll be back with more of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram.
Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor is underwritten by Franklin County Technical School. We build futures. Visit fcts.us or call 413-863-9561.
Welcome back to Financial Fitness. I'm Jay Dean, along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram. And a not you. I heard you do that the other day. You went, doctor, doctor, doctor. It's kind of,
Well, that was from MASH.
yeah.
Do you
Oh, yeah.
concur, doctor, doctor, doctor? Can you
Right.
tell I watch old stuff?
Yeah.
Okay.
Great.
So before we went to break, Dr. Kucherov was talking about a statistic that they quote, and I wanted to get a little bit more into that. So can you give us a little background there?
Yes, absolutely. Most of the fertility centers in the United States belong to an organization called SART, SART, Society for Assisted Reproductive Technology, and report success rates. And you can go to the, you can just Google SART, SART database, and you can look up all the fertility practices in the country and what the success rates are with IVF, with embryo transfers, with donor eggs or donor embryos, or whatever the case may be. And it's broken down by, if you are a new patient at such and such age, what is your chance of leaving with a baby, basically, or on a per egg retrieval basis or on a per embryo transfer basis? Importantly, you want to look at the finalized data, not the preliminary data. Preliminary data, they're still waiting for people to report pregnancy outcomes. So I would ignore that and look at the finalized data.
So is this the same as the CDC art or not?
No, it is
Aha.
different. It's different information, different.
Oh, interesting.
They're slightly different ways.
You would trust the SART more than the CDC ART?
The SART practices are
I've put you on the spot.
our lab here holds the SART practices and knows that they are generally speaking of a high standard, and
Okay.
thus we typically use that data more commonly than the CDC data.
Okay, so now I really do want to ask you something that I read. So clinics vary widely, right, in their success rates. Some programs have below 10% success rate for certain patients, or age brackets, I guess, and others exceed 60% in young, healthy populations. What could explain, I'm sure there's a long list, but what do you think can explain this wide variance?
So the biggest thing that can explain it is the quality of the lab and the lab practices. I've been in this practice for about 5 years now, and I was at a different practice before, which also had an excellent lab. And honestly, we can do whatever we can as medical providers and physicians, et cetera, to try to do the best we can and get the best result. But if the lab isn't doing what they need to do, it's not going to be as great a chance of success. We're very lucky here that we have an amazing lab. So I'm very grateful to them for all the work that they do. The other piece of it is that the way that the IVF cycles are done, and specifically about what happens to the embryos and the information you gather about the embryos, can greatly affect success rates. And this is why it's important to know the way the data is reported. So as an example, like we talked about before, as we go on in life, there's a higher chance of chromosomal genetic abnormalities happening with embryos. If you report data on a per embryo transfer basis, and you're doing testing of all the embryos, and you're eliminating all the embryos that have major genetic abnormalities that will always result in a negative test or an early pregnancy loss, and you're just transferring embryos that have the best possible chance of success, your success rates will be higher. If you don't do a lot of chromosome testing of embryos in your practice, necessarily, especially once we get over age 38, the rates will be lower. If you look on the SART website, it will say, hey, this clinic does a lot of PGT, pre-implantation genetic testing. And that's actually reported by the practice. I will say our practice does do a lot of chromosome testing. You certainly don't need to. A lot of our folks are in that sort of like mid to late 30s, early 40s age group and want to do chromosome testing before doing embryo transfer. It's certainly not necessary, but on a per embryo transfer basis for many patients, it may increase the pregnancy rate.
I have to tell you, if I was over 35 wanting to have a baby, I would definitely want the chromosome testing. Heartbreaking to do this over and over again and have it fail and expensive.
Absolutely. Even under the best of circumstances, you do chromosome testing of an embryo. Oh, good, positive pregnancy test. Everything looks great. There's still a 10 to 15% chance of a pregnancy loss under those circumstances for many different reasons, usually something genetic that cannot be picked up on the chromosome testing. I mean, the technology does not exist to do whole exome sequencing of embryos. And even if we could, there are so many genes and variants in the genome that we have no idea what they do, that it would be hard to pick that out and say, oh, this is obviously the reason why there's a pregnancy loss, or you shouldn't use the embryo for that reason. Very, very difficult.
Okay, we never tell you, we never punch you here without giving you a pillow. Usually it's a problem and a solution. But in this case, I'm just going to give you some good news. According to the CDC stats, assisted reproductive technology, ART, and it may be higher, you may be able to tell me that it's even higher in real life, the use is increasing. And in 2023, I know it's 2 years old, they're slow getting us stats from the government, US fertility clinics reported over 95,000 babies born from ART cycles. So
It's
that's the good
amazing.
news.
It's amazing the technology has improved by leaps and bounds. I mean, there's that Friends episode from 20 years ago where Phoebe puts in five embryos and gets triplets. That's pretty rare, but nobody does that anymore. We do one, sometimes two, but that's because the technology is much better and are able to choose the embryos to get the best chance of success. But again, nothing's ever 100%. I will also point out that that is the right year to use data from,
Oh, really?
because pregnancies that occurred in 2023 were delivered in 2024. And sometimes people that may have made embryos in 2023 may not have used them until 2024 and not had their baby until this year. And that gets fed back to that 2023 calendar year. So that's the correct year to use currently.
Oh, that's great. Okay, so now that we're into that zone, let me ask you, for our followers who might not know, can you explain how you decide between starting with something like intrauterine insemination, IUI, versus moving directly to in vitro fertilization, IVF, which I
Sure.
think is the one everybody's like, oh, IVF is so expensive.
And absolutely. I would say generally, the medically appropriate thing to do first is a fertility checkup, for the patient, the female patient, and if there's a male partner, for the male partner. So we check the sperm, the numbers of sperm. We check the uterus to make sure there's nothing going on inside the uterus that might interfere with pregnancy or increase risk of pregnancy loss. We check the fallopian tubes with an X-ray of the belly. To make sure the tubes are open, and we check the egg numbers with ultrasound and with blood work. Do you like this?
I just love that you used belly. We check an X-ray of the belly. I could see it now on the medical charts in school. And what's this part, Alex? That's the belly. I love it. Okay.
We do a hysterosalpingogram,
Thank
which
you.
is
Say
a
that three times
fluoroscopic
fast.
evaluation of the pelvis, the fallopian tubes.
I just love that you mixed it, that you made it accessible. We do all these medical things, and the belly is very cute. I can see why you're popular.
And sometimes there are obvious things going on that would say we need to do high-level fertility treatment. If the sperm numbers are very, very low, then low-level interventions have almost no chance of success, less than 1% chance of success. If the fallopian tubes are blocked, the egg and the sperm cannot meet. We have to do IVF to bypass the tubes. Many folks can start with low-level fertility interventions, though. There are very few things where it's like you need to do IVF as the first choice.
Yeah, so that brings up a question about new technologies and Are there new technologies like genetic testing, egg freezing, which we were talking about waiting, don't wait, or lab innovations? We talked about your lab a little bit that are changing not only the success rates, but the cost equation.
This is a really hot area right now. Fertility itself is a hot area of research, and how to innovate and, in some cases, automate the IVF lab is really coming through right now. I will say that, generally speaking, we want the process to be as efficient as possible, and more importantly, as safe as possible. And having a lot of checks and balances in the lab is extremely important. So, for example, we have multi-factor authentication of gametes, of embryos, multiple embryologists checking to make sure it's the right embryo. And we have a barcode RFID system that's electronically linked to the embryos.
Cool.
Patients identify their full name and their medical record number on the straw the embryo is in, all these different things. So for safety, of course.
That's great.
But there are many innovations coming to the IVF lab that, IVF generally looks different than 20 years ago. And 20 years from now, it's going to look very different. There are companies that are private companies that are making machines that can do basically the whole IVF process without any people, without embryologists to do most of the things. So there are
Not
machines
without,
that
not
can,
without any people.
oh,
There
a slower
has
number,
to be somebody
somebody
involved.
there. There's fewer people, let's say. But now
Okay.
they have machines that can take the eggs and put them in the dish and add the sperm on top, or even do ICSI, put one sperm under the microscope into the egg under the microscope, and then take that embryo, put it to the incubator. We have, and that's coming through. There's a lab in Mexico that's doing that already, and
Wow.
they're going to be bringing it probably to this country very soon to check it out. There are lots of other technologies, such as time-lapse photography of embryos, and there is it's a little bit controversial about how it affects outcomes, but there is emerging evidence that embryos that develop and grow perhaps slightly faster on a slightly faster scale might have better outcomes. There's all kinds of things like that that happen in the lab, but it's all very expensive. And there is, our job, we feel, is to really extract every single percentage point chance of success. And sometimes it does end up being expensive for that reason.
Well, I'm going to say that you gave me the willies a little bit when we were talking about labs that don't do genetic testing and how many times you might have to go through this process, because my cynical, my terrible, Jay knows where I'm headed. My cynical monetary side says, financial side says, oh, you have to go through it more times. That's more money. I'm sure that's probably not calculated that way, but I wouldn't put it past some places that, oh, you just got to do it again. You just got to keep trying, shell out some more money.
Can
It's
I give you an
really,
example of that if that's okay?
yeah, I think it's got to be like the lowest of low to prey on people like this, but sure, bring it on.
Well, the evidence is that doing chromosome testing, it doesn't increase your chance of having a baby from the group of embryos you make. It allows you to skip the embryos that have literally no chance, right? So, but if you're in your late 30s, early 40s, the majority of embryos you make are going to be abnormal. From a financial standpoint, let's say you're paying out of pocket. To do an embryo transfer cycle could be $4,000 or $5,000 to prep the uterus and do the actual and thaw the embryo and transfer the embryo. $4,000 or $5,000 to do one embryo transfer. To do testing of embryos can be in the neighborhood of $1,500 to check as many embryos as you have, and maybe $200 to $250 per embryo. So that is, for me, and for your listeners, I'm sure, not super hard math to do that. If you can do that and save yourself, maybe upfront it's a little more expensive, but it could save you spending $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 in embryos that had literally no chance of working,
Yes.
then that might be a good decision.
Yeah. Do you think people know about this in the general populace? Is this commonly known that you might want this genetic testing?
I think it's becoming more clear with recent news the past couple of years. I think people are becoming more aware of it. A lot of people do fertility treatment in this country, and like we talked about before, people don't love to talk about it. It's considered super personal, which that's certainly a personal decision about people sharing fertility stories and journeys. I will say
Yeah.
most of the fertility information is not super widely available. It's not really taught in schools as much as I personally think it should. I'm biased, of course, but I think it should be taught more in school.
Well, we're in the same camp there. I think finance should be taught in school too, but we're not teaching those things.
Well, for families who, I just think it's so miraculous when you think back to, let's say, the start of the 20th century in 1900. Now you can just, as we've been talking about, family building, you can go and get some information, find out what's going on. I mean, but it's just so miraculous,
Things were so different back then. People were having families in their teens and 20s, the majority of people, when there are often less fertility issues that can occur. But also, if there were fertility issues, people certainly didn't talk about it, even like today. And people don't love talking about it today. But certainly at that time, it was really, my understanding was, really not in the culture. And you never heard about those stories either, right? It wasn't, they weren't publicized like on nowadays on Twitter and Instagram.
Well, I think taboo comes to mind. Money used to be the same thing. It still is a lot. People will not admit having money problems or money questions or not being good with money or money arguments or any of those things. It's just there's something about our society that says that's not appropriate to discuss. And
That's why you're there. So, speaking of that, Francis, can we get your phone number?
Sure. It's 413-773-3333.
Or, as always, go to hugyourmoney.com. And again, join us next time around for Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram.
Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor is underwritten by Hug Your Money. Hug Your Money, where financial wellness gets personal. Will you help us spread the word about financial fitness? Please like, subscribe, and choose all. Thank you.